From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We think we know the Holocaust, the evil, the anti-Semitism, the toll. But historian Timothy Snyder says we've missed a lot. In particular, that one of the roots behind the madness was an ecological panic, says Snyder. Hitler's rage to seize the black earth of Eastern Europe, to secure agricultural land, to feed Germans, and yes, to wipe out the Jews. Climate change could spark panic again, he warns. This hour on Point, Holocaust history and the new danger of resource wars, ecological panic. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this how it could happen again? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Timothy Snyder, history professor at Yale University and author of Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Timothy Snyder is a member of the Committee on Conscience at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Timothy Snyder, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
There's a lot of history here. It's very layered. It is gripping and, of course, vastly tragic. I want to go first to the warning that you're making here. You've written since the book came out in a piece called The Next Genocide. You're really pointing to climate change. And in the subtitle of your book itself, you said there's a warning. There's a warning, not just history, but a warning here. What's your current warning when it comes to the ecology, the environment, climate change?
Well, I tend to think in general, Tom, that history is an opportunity for us to take some perspective, to get some perspective on ourselves, to see how our own position might not be so different from past positions. The thing about our generations, the ones who control social and political life now, intellectual life now, is that we have been living in a very special kind of resource bubble. We are the only generation or generations in the history of humankind where food and politics have been separated. Or to put it in a different way, we are the first couple of generations in the history of modern social life, economic life, where calories have been a bad thing. Up until the Second World War, a calorie was a unit of energy. It was something that one had to have to keep animals and human beings going, to keep economies going. So the way that we have understood the Holocaust, I think, has to do with the fact that we live in a world of plenty. Hitler, the Germans of the 1930s, humanity in general in the 1930s did not live in that same world of plenty. They lived in a world where access to food was unpredictable, where even rich societies like Germany were dependent upon unpredictable international markets, where Germany had been recently blockaded. So I think where we have to start when we understand the warning is our own nature. Are we really so generous and tolerant as we think we are? Or if the notch was just turned a tiny bit, if the world changed just a little bit so that it were a bit more like the 1930s, would developed countries, whether it's China or some other developed country, behave a bit more like Germany in the 1930s than we would really like to think?
You've written, talking about Goebbels, the chief Nazi propagandist, Joseph Goebbels, you've written, could therefore, with this fear of hunger or lack of food resources, could therefore define the purpose of a war of extermination as a, quote, a big breakfast, a big lunch, and a big dinner. He, Goebbels, you write, conflated lifestyle with life and was willing to go after a whole people on the basis of that. I want you to make those connections for us, but take us to that obsession with food and Hitler's obsession with Lebensraum or living space, room to live.
Mm-hmm. So when we use the word Lebensraum, we use this German word, it makes it sound like something exotic, something distant from us. And that's a danger I think in general we have when we talk about the Nazis. I noticed that we use German words when we want to put them in some place which is far from us. But the politics of Lebensraum are actually not that hard to understand. They're really not so different from the way that we look at the world, especially when we look at the world in times of stress. So Lebensraum, or living space, which is all it means, basically has two meanings. On the one hand, Hitler is saying that the planet is a finite space. We are all divided up. Humanity is divided up into races. All that matters in the world is that races compete for limited resources. They compete for land. They compete for food. And along the way, they starve each other to death. And that, says Hitler, is perfectly natural. And all that we should do, says Hitler, is we should have solidarity with members of our own race. In other words, he says—
And doesn't mean the human race.
No, no, no. He means races in the sense of biological races.
Yeah, ethnicity, we might say today.
Yeah, we might. You know, whatever you might think your people is, mm-hmm. if you want this to seem a little bit closer mm-hmm. to home. So Hitler says, if you feel anxious about resources, if you feel that things are changing, it's perfectly natural to strike out. But then Lebensraum also has another logic, and that's the logic of lifestyle. Hitler also says it's normal to want more than what other people have. It's normal to want ever more. It's normal to want to keep up with the Joneses. It's normal if Germans want to have the lifestyle that Americans have. It's normal to want ever more, more, more. And so there's another logic of insatiability, not just a logic of survival, but also the logic of lifestyle. So Hitler says, if you want more and more and more, that's also natural. So Lebensraum, the idea that you have to seize more land, both it seizes on anxiety, it seizes on survivalist emotions, which we of course also experience, but it also seizes on consumerism. It seizes on the desire to do as well or better than everyone else, which is also a feeling that I would venture to say most of us also experience.
I mean, you don't have to say Lebensraum. You can. I mean, Daniel Boone had elbow room. Americans know that very well, and went in search for it. Took it from other people. But here we are in Hitler's case. Was there a real resource shortage? You're comparing it to climate change times, and when you say ecological panic, these days it puts us in the mind of these sort of apocalyptic scenarios that people imagine is potentially coming with sea level rise and, you know, superstorms and all the rest. Was Germany at this time in the 30s, 20s really facing an environmental threat?
Let me just first pick up on the Daniel Boone reference, mm-hmm. because it's actually really important, and I think it's another way to help bring this home.
Okay.
I grew up in the 1970s, and you know there was a song amidst the Saturday morning cartoons that I watched about elbow room, right? Mm-hmm. And it was only in the 1990s, as I began to read this literature, that I realized that elbow room was in fact Lebensraum. That it is basically the same concept,
yeah.
and that's not an abstract realization that you and I are having. That is how Adolf Hitler saw it. Adolf Hitler looked at the American frontier and treated it as his model. What he wanted to do precisely, and he put it in so many words, was reproduce the American experience in Eastern Europe. He wanted the frontier empire in Eastern Europe. And so he talked about the Ukrainians and the Russians as being like Indians, for example. And he believed that when he fought a war in Eastern Europe, the result for them would be exactly the same thing. Now, getting to your question about whether there was actually an apocalypse, a catastrophe on the horizon, it's a little bit more complicated than that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not talking about a present resource crunch, which leads to immediate action. That is, of course, bad enough. And in the world that we're living in, we have those things. If we look at the genocide in Rwanda, that was after a crop failure the year before. If we look at Sudan, that happened, Darfur, that happens when drought drives certain peoples from north to south and the government exterminates other peoples. If we look at what's happening in Syria today, the civil war is in large measure a result of 4 years of drought, which drove people from what we used to call but can no longer call the Fertile Crescent into the cities, right? So it's clear that you can have immediate resource crunches which have consequences which are frankly bad enough, hundreds of thousands of deaths. But what you and I are talking about is something a little more complex.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about is when a developed country, a powerful country, a country that has the ability to look ahead, right, feels that some kind of catastrophe might be coming. And here the sense of time is incredibly important, because another thing which Hitler does, and this is another thing which should resonate with us, is that he says that science doesn't work. He says specifically that we can't count on scientific progress to deliver enough food for survival or for lifestyle. And since we can't count on science, the future, as it were, collapses. He's doing away with the sense that we might have, that we have techniques which might resolve some of these pressures. And he's insisting that we have to act now. We have to act now to seize things, to seize land. And this is a political logic, right? Because, of course, you can invest in science. You can invest in the future. This applies to climate change, obviously, as well. You can say there is a threat, but we can start working against that threat now. Or you can say science doesn't work. Let's do nothing. Let's await the worst. So in a way, we're facing a choice which, although it's not exactly the same, of course, as Germany in the 1930s, there is a parallel. We can say science works, or we can say science doesn't work. And we should be aware when we make this choice that Hitler said that science doesn't work. And that's part of what we're talking about when we talk about ecological panic. Ecological panic is a political logic.
Why did Hitler's ecological panic turn him so destructively to the Jews?
He has a worldview which we associate with nationalism or with authoritarianism or with anti-Semitism. Those words are all in a way true, but they're not quite enough. What Hitler says is that the natural struggle, the racial struggle, is the only natural thing. That's the way the world is. There are so many resources. There's a limited amount of land. There's only so much food. And the only real action in the world is the struggle for resources, for land, for food. If we have any other ideas in our minds, whether those ideas are Christian mercy, socialist solidarity, capitalism and its legal contracts, if we have any other ideas in our mind besides the ones which impel us to work together with our race to seize resources, if we have those ideas, says Hitler, this is because we were under the influence of Jews. So what we call Hitler's anti-Semitism is in fact the idea that Jews have to be eradicated so that the normal course of affairs, this bloody resource struggle, can happen. And here I'd like to emphasize one thing. Hitler blames the Jews for Christian mercy. He blames them for communism. He blames them for capitalism. But he also blames them for the view that universal science could come to the rescue. He says that if people accept that science can work, they fall in prey to a Jewish swindle. And this, it seems to me, is something very important to remember.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new warning of climate change raising the danger of resource wars, a warning rooted in the history of Hitler and the Holocaust. My guest today is Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale, author of Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. Here's a little of the sound of that history newsreel from September 1939. You'll hear an unnamed radio host reading a communique from a Warsaw, Poland radio station.
On the 1st of September 1939, at dawn, the Germans crossed into our territory. German Air Force and regular army unexpectedly invaded Polish territory without a declaration of hostilities. In the early morning, the German airplanes attacked a number of towns all over Poland.
Nazi Germany looking for Lebensraum, living space. Call it elbow room if you like. Here's Hitler, Adolf Hitler, in January 1940. Talking about his idea of Lebensraum, living space, from a speech in Berlin. What we regarded as building blocks for our new Reich, besides our willpower, Hitler's saying here, was first, our Volks, or people's ability to work, second, their intelligence, and third, what our soil, our Lebensraum, afforded us. Go and get it. Go and take it. You can join us this hour. Can you picture drought and flood and fear, rage for resources, land, sending countries to war in this century? Was that just Hitler's overactive imagination at work? Or does that war danger always rise when resource fears grow? Are we still thinking of climate change as a problem for polar bears and coral reefs? What about for us, our peace and safety, humans? What do you make of Timothy Snyder's link between ecological panic and the Holocaust? Will we keep our cool if things get hot on the climate front? Cindy's calling from Springfield, Illinois, land of Lincoln. Cindy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Curious, and I'm hoping it's not my overactive imagination. Okay. I attend a lot of auctions here in central Illinois. Have noticed lately, in the last couple of years, an influx of Chinese buyers buying farmland. Well, obviously, here in central Illinois, we're going to be exempt from the flooding of rising waters. You know, we have some of the most pristine soil that there is. And if by chance they want to come knocking on the door for our debt, they already own our farmland. I'm, you know, kind of just putting two and two together here.
Cindy, I appreciate your call. Tim Snyder, respond to Cindy in Illinois watching the Chinese at auction. You remind us Chinese owners now own about 10% of the arable land in the Ukraine. We're not going for the panic button here, but people do look for resources when they wonder about the future.
Yes, Cindy has noticed a sign of a global trend, which is very important. These things are already underway. Let's think about China for just a second. Mm-hmm. China is like Germany in the 1930s in the following ways. It's a big industrial power. It's dependent upon international markets for food, which it can't produce for itself. Unlike Germany, it has another problem, which is that it doesn't have enough water. The water supplies and its arable soil are both diminishing year by year, partly as a result of global warming. China, like Germany, can project power around the world, and the Chinese are already looking ahead. This is what I meant when I talked about powerful countries and their ability to see the future. So the Chinese are investing in Africa. They seem to be investing in Ukraine, and they're also investing around the world. Is this necessarily a bad thing? We'll see.
And you don't mean in factories. You mean in arable land.
Yeah, this is what they lack. And they're trying to control vast swaths of territory around the world. Now, will this be a bad thing? What about in 25 years when the Chinese and the Africans are going to be competing for arable soil in Africa? In the short term, one of the things we notice is that when there's a drought, as there is ever so often these days, the Chinese panic buy. And the result is that prices on international markets go up, which leads to food riots and political instability. This is one of the sources, actually, of the Arab Spring and the current instability in the Middle East. So Chinese actions already affect the international economy. And if we look to Germany in the 1930s, none of this is particularly unexpected.
There's a cool response to this, which is to look to science, first of all, to try and ameliorate climate change, to try and slow it, stop it. And secondly, to look to political institutions to coordinate, right, so that we work together instead of tangling with one another for resources. Hitler rejected both of those. What about now?
So this is why I see history as really an opportunity. We look at the Holocaust and we learn lessons about identity politics. That's not enough. There are these two hard lessons that you mentioned. The first is that one has to embrace science in order to buy time, at the very least, because if you don't buy time, if everyone has the sense that there is no time, that's what panic means. Panic is what happens when you think you need something and you need it right away. Second point's also very important. The Holocaust could only unfold insofar as Hitler destroyed political structures in Eastern Europe. And one of the problems that we're having with global warming today is that it independently also weakens state structures, as in the Middle East and in sub-Saharan Africa now. We see it before our eyes. So it's very important, I think, also to draw that lesson from the Holocaust, that we need states that are functional if we're going to be able to handle the changes that are coming.
Jonathan, in Spokane, Washington, you're on the air with Timothy Schneider.
Hi. Thank you for having this conversation today because it's relevant to what is happening in Syria and our involvement in Syria. So specifically, I'm thinking of an article that I saw in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science by Colin Kelly and colleagues called Climate Change in the Fertile Crescent and its Implications of the Recent Syrian Drought. The population of Syria went from, in 1950, 4 million people to 2008, about 22 million people. And so they were teetering on the edge of the carrying capacity of the land. Then about 2008, there was an epic drought there, which, according to climate models, was a product, at least in part, of anthropogenic climate change. So then the wells go dry, people start starving, and there's a war. Now, the U.S., we've taken this as an opportunity to talk about despotic regimes and democracy, mm-hmm. but it's not about regime change. It's about climate change, really, and that was the seed for the war. So we need to be aware of this, and this needs to be part of our foreign policy viewpoint.
Maybe science denial right there. I mean, it's not complete denial. I've got a little tape here. This is from July. Former Maryland governor and now Democratic presidential candidate Martin O'Malley, you'll see him in the Democratic debates tonight. He was talking with Bloomberg Television about exactly that, Jonathan, there in Spokane, the situation in Syria and climactic challenges.
One of the things that preceded the failure of the nation state of Syria and the rise of ISIS was the effect of climate change and the mega drought that affected that region, wiped out farmers, drove people to cities, created a humanitarian crisis.
And the president, Obama, talking at the Coast Guard Academy in May, also warning of the challenge of climate change to security.
Climate change constitutes a serious threat to global security, an immediate risk to our national security. And make no mistake, it will impact how our military defends our country.
The Holocaust, Timothy Snyder, you remind us, really got going out in these lands beyond the borders of Germany, where Hitler was pursuing this grab for resources, grab for land and space. How there and why there?
So the to try to answer your question and Jonathan's point at the same time, mm-hmm. there are three things that have to be at play for something like a Holocaust to take place. There does have to be the bad leader and the ideology that we don't like. The problem is that it's actually not so easy to get bad leaders and ideologies that we don't like out of the way. The second thing there has to be is an ecological panic, a sense that one has to seize land, territory, resources right away. And the third thing, as you say, is state destruction. Institutions have to fail. When we look at the Holocaust, what we see is that actually 97% of the Jews who died lived beyond Germany. We see that the killing
97%.
Wow. And we see that the entire event took place in a zone in Eastern Europe, which the Germans deliberately made stateless. We also see the killing could
meaning
only
meaning they tore down the elements of the institutions of politics there and made it kind of a free fire zone.
Exactly. The tape that you played, it was not about the beginning of a conventional war in Poland. Mm-hmm. Hitler told his generals that the idea was to wipe out the Polish state, to wipe out its political classes. They treated Poland as a colonial zone in which there not only were no laws, but there couldn't be any laws. And they did basically the same thing in the Soviet Union. That is what enables Hitler's view of life as a racial conflict to actually be realized. And it's only in zones like that where a policy of total destruction of a people can actually be implemented.
Jeff in Norfolk, Virginia. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wonder, with regard to climate change, if the scenario will be more like what we're seeing currently in Europe with waves of immigrants from Iraq, Syria, North Africa, mass migrating to northern hemispheres when the climate affects their own condition so poorly and the impact that will have on those countries and societies.
You mean
obviously, Europe's not been able to prevent that.
Are you suggesting, Jeff, that we are now more likely to see waves of refugees than powerful nations reaching out to take over land and resources?
Exactly.
Tim Snyder?
I think we should keep all these scenarios in mind. And this goes back a bit to Jonathan's question as well. The particulars of Syria do involve climate change. They also involve state destruction, because when the United States changed regime in Iraq, that led to more than a million refugees to Syria, which was part of the problem there. But I would also see Syria in this light as a larger trend, as Jeff says, of south to north migration. There are going to be different conflicts, different political modalities, but until we get a handle on climate change, this is going to happen. And we will tend to talk about it in terms of the bad leaders and the ideologies we don't like. But what we can do to actually change it is to address climate change. Now, with Europe, the danger is that the political consensus that prevails in Europe now, learning lessons from the Second World War, could be toppled as right-wing populism becomes more significant. And unfortunately, even though European civil society is reacting very well to the refugees, and some leaders such as Chancellor Merkel are behaving amazingly well, nevertheless, if one looks at the polls, it's the case that right-wing populism is becoming ever more important. This could bring down the European Union, which would mean the end of the post-war answer to precisely the 1930s. So that's the scenario that I fear moving forward in Europe itself.
Do you see clearly the room for conflict is there. The grab for resources, but are you describing genocide as somehow inherent to this sort of thrust, or was that Hitler's freaky spin on it?
Well, we have to think about what humans are capable of. What we are capable of doing is taking things from others. We're capable of killing others in very large numbers as we do it, but we're also capable of coming up with sophisticated ideas which seem to justify doing so as we're doing it in retrospect, whatever you might want. So the main point that I'm trying to make is that Hitler's ideology, although it's repulsive and unreal, is a perfectly coherent way of approaching the world, and that other people could come up with other perfectly coherent ways of approaching the world, which might seem to justify killing before it happens, as it happens, after it happens. As human beings, this is part of our nature. This is part of what we're capable of doing.
Historian Timothy Snyder's book is Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. Tim Snyder, please stand by in New Haven. With us right now from Washington is Francesco Femia, co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. It's a think tank focused on the interactions between climate change and security issues. Francesco Femia, Frank Femia, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
You see, you may have read Tim Snyder's warning here in a very deep layered history of Nazi Germany. You know, he's got the warning right there in his title. This isn't just history. He's trying to make us look at this today and see the risk. Do you see elements of this playing out already? We've heard some of the Syrian examples cited. When you look around, do you see tendrils or more of what he's describing?
Thanks, Tom. It's a good question, and I think it's very important for us to sort of to look at not just the resource stresses and the climatic stresses that that can lead to the kinds of decisions that were made by authoritarian leaders in the past regarding resources, but also to look at sort of the political sort of element of scarcity and the political decisions that are made around resources and what role that plays in these kinds of outcomes. So and so let's take a look at Syria, for example. We sort of began that dialogue on the climate resource conflict nexus within Syria with some research back in 2012. And what we found was, as a caller mentioned before, and as Tim mentioned as well, there was a major drought from 2007 to 2011 that contributed to the decimation of a significant portion of Syria's arable land, about 75% crop failure in some regions, and also about 85% of livestock lost by herders throughout the country. That particular drought was made 2 to 3 times more likely by climate change, and that is due to, or at least confirmed by, a recent study by Colin Kelly, which a caller mentioned before. However, there are a number of other dynamics that helped drive that decimation of cropland and rangeland, which ultimately led to about 2 million people having to flee, mostly into urban areas. And that were decisions that the al-Assad regime had made itself about where to put its or about what its priorities were, where to put its resources. For example, the Assad regime had been heavily subsidizing very water-intensive cash crops like cotton. The Syrian regime also prided itself, unlike a number of other Middle Eastern countries which were heavily dependent on the global wheat market, prided itself on producing its own wheat, or a lot of its own wheat. Wheat is, of course, a very water-intensive crop. And those dynamics also, connected with sort of overgrazing of land that was mismanaged by the Assad regime, led to the decimation of Syria's water table. And then on top of that, you had a drought, a major drought, which may have been driven by climate change. And then what happened in that context was the Assad regime made some political decisions. For example, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that the Assad regime was awarding well drilling contracts based on sectarian and ethnic lines. The Assad regime, being an Alawite regime, was apparently giving those contracts mostly to its ethnic compatriots, Alawites, in certain parts of the country, and that may have fed into discontent about the Assad regime's sense of justice.
And right there, you're bringing that threat of race or ethnicity or sect, if you will. Maybe there's a thread to the Hitler story right there.
I think it's sort of we're seeing signs of that. So in this particular case, the Assad regime makes a choice about its own political survival. Makes a choice about what is best for its own regime. And in this particular case, it makes a choice based on ethnicity. And yeah, so if we're seeing more of these stresses in the future, if we're seeing climate change exacerbate water stresses in the future, then governments, particularly those governments that are already authoritarian in nature, may make some very brutal decisions.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new warning of climate change, raising the danger of resource wars, a warning rooted in the history of Hitler and the Holocaust. Timothy Snyder writes it up in his quite impressive new book, Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning, a sort of new interpretation of what went on, a lot of it beyond the borders of Germany, where Germans were looking for what Hitler called Lebensraum, living space. They took a lot, and most of the Holocaust, the killing, took place there. He joins us today from New Haven, Connecticut. He's professor of history at Yale University. From Washington, Francesco Frank Femia is with us, co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Security. You can join us as well in this hour. What do you think? Will we keep our cool if things get hot on the climate front? Will we turn to science and political institutions to surmount the challenges, to hold it together or not? Are you hearing yet another reason this hour to go green? Will in Miami, Florida. Thank you for calling, Will. You're on the air.
I just wanted to comment that most of us Americans don't think that that ever happened in the United States, this kind of situation. However, I agree with the author because, in my humble opinion, it has already happened in case in Point, California, the nurse and all and what happens with all the
Will, your phone's dying on us, but I could just make out Tim Snyder, Will, saying we feel like this wouldn't happen here, but he's already seen it in New Orleans during Katrina. He saw how people react when resources become scarce. I mean, when it becomes acute, lots of people can react in pretty ugly ways, Tim.
He's got his finger on something very important. We treat the Holocaust as a matter of identity politics, and so we say, well, we're not racist, so we're not anti-Semites, so something like this couldn't happen. But the moment that structures change, or the moment that structures go away, our commitments, unfortunately, our ethical commitments can also evaporate pretty quickly. New Orleans during Katrina is a very, very small taste of what statelessness looks like. People go after resources. There's no law in the way. Now, imagine that being magnified by 100 or 1,000 or 100,000 or a million, and then you have Eastern Europe during the Second World War. So what we're talking about is a universal issue. Without structure, things are possible, which we wouldn't think the day before were possible.
Ruthann in Cheswell, Delaware. Ruthann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much, Timothy. Great book. I had two quick comments, and I'll take my answers off the air. The first is that I was trained in South Africa at University of Cape Town in conflict analysis and mediation in the late 90s, and we were taught that all wars are resource wars. That was just a basis for the beginning of an analysis. And then I looked at our situation here on this continent with Native Americans and thought, wow, that wasn't resource wars, that was just, you know, gold seekers and refugees of other wars. But now I do see it as a resource war in that Native Americans on this continent don't have rights to their own resources, and they are in many ways stateless, vying for the privilege of self-governance. So those are my two comments. I had one last inkling during the last talk, mm-hmm. during Timothy's last mm-hmm. words, mm-hmm. that if we have a science based on living earth-based science, it would be very different than a science based on human dominance. Just throwing that out there. Thanks so much, you guys. You're great. I'll take my answer off the air.
Living earth-based science. Let me hold that thought and pick up, if I may, I hope, Ruthann, on your history lesson or insight there for a moment first. John, with one more call. John, on the Seneca Nation Reservation in New York State. John, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to go a little farther than what the previous caller went. I mean, Manifest Destiny is absolutely comparable to everything that Hitler was doing in Eastern Europe, and it was ethnic based. It was race based. When you consider the doctrine of Christian discovery, especially on the heels of celebrating Columbus Day yesterday, the doctrine of Christian discovery is actually the doctrine of dominance. It would actually be the doctrine of white supremacy because it promoted this ideal that that Christian nations from Europe, predominantly white nations, could basically take resources. And in the case of the United States, you consider the westward expansion and the killing and the pillaging of native resources and native peoples and native lands is absolutely comparable. And in fact, it is pretty clear that Hitler drew many of his lessons from the treatment of native people in the United States. So, as the previous caller says, it's not just a question of whether it could happen. It certainly has happened, and many of us native people, we are still living within this culture of domination, even though there is no place in American history that you can say that we've ever transferred our sovereignty to the United States.
John, I appreciate your call. And yes, you heard Timothy Snyder say earlier it was an explicit source of inspiration, I guess, to Adolf Hitler in his own time. I want to come back to Ruth Ann's thought on science, but if I may first, Frank Femia in Washington, you mentioned Syria earlier as a prime example right now of how resource problems, climate change problems, can lead to meltdown, in this case, civil war. What about others around the world where you see a kind of fraying, climate change-based, that it points in ominous directions now, Frank?
Yeah, so I think we can – Syria is a particularly acute case where we see a lot of these dynamics coming together, climate, social, political, demographic dynamics coming together at a point in time that leads to, I think, what Tim talks about in his book, sort of these moments of a lack of governance, which can lead to instability. And I think it's important to sort of focus in on that because right up to the initiation of the uprising in Syria, most political and intelligence analysts were determining that Syria was a stable nation. So I think I just wanted to come back to that and make that clear that we're not just talking about fragile nations that are at risk of climate change. We're also talking about seemingly stable nations. And that's really relevant when we look at the rest of the world. We can look at very vulnerable places that are experiencing a whole host of security issues. For example, Pakistan, which suffers from a lack of governance in a lot of its areas, suffers from the proliferation of nuclear weapons, suffers from terrorism and being a home base for international terrorism. But it's also a very vulnerable place in terms of its water resources. Most of Central Asia gets its water, its fresh water, from the Himalayan glaciers, and we know that the Himalayan glaciers are starting to melt. And so what's that going to mean for places like Pakistan, which is already very fragile? However, when we look beyond places like Pakistan, it's important for us to not sort of be complacent about the fact that seemingly stable countries can potentially become far more unstable than they are today, and could sort of devolve into, or could lead, and that could lead to governments making some very authoritarian decisions, or more authoritarian decisions than we already see. And I think Tim talked about China, and it's important to look at China because China is a very water poor nation. When you look at the amount of water it has compared to the number of people it has to provide for. And we need to think about China not just as a global power, but as a state that's potentially very fragile and very vulnerable to the effects of climate change. And we need to think about what that's going to mean. We talked a little bit about some of the sort of land leasing and land purchases that China is making in other countries, including Eastern Europe, including East and in Sub-Saharan Africa. And that is, of course, a form of broadening living space. I mean, that land that's being leased in certain African countries is producing food primarily for Chinese consumption. And what does that mean for those Africans who live in those countries who don't have access to that land? So I think we need to think about how these sort of the instability that may flow from natural resource crisis can affect not just those countries that we know are fragile, whether it's Sudan or East Africa or now Syria, Pakistan, but what it means for currently stable countries.
We've got Timothy Snyder reminds us China already leasing 10% of Ukraine's arable soil. Other countries or companies in other countries, the United Arab Emirates, South Korea, looking at Sudan's fertile regions. Tim Snyder says, joined by Japan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, efforts to buy or lease land throughout Africa. Kate in New York, Vestal, New York. Thank you for calling, Kate. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is so important, and I think your author is so insightful. But my comment is, I'm not just concerned about the races competing for resources, but corporations seem to be taking resources. For example, hydrofracking takes millions of gallons of water and is put into the earth, and not all of it, in fact, less than half comes back up. And another example, I have a concern when California is having such a drought, Nestle's has water rights, and they were shipping their water to other states for because profit was more the priority than leaving it in California. So I'm just concerned to corporations taking our resources and having control.
Kate, I appreciate your call. Tim Snyder, you've got nations and races and corporations. Has the mix of players changed in a significant way since World War II?
Well, it's not a big theme of the book, but of course corporations, in the German case, adapted very well to the incentives that were given to them. So the biggest German companies did their very best to make profit out of, for example, Auschwitz or out of the advantages of slave labor. And the lesson I draw from that is that markets are always going to be present. What matters is the incentive structures that you create. And with things like carbon pollution or water use, part of the solution, not all of the solution, but part of the solution is going to have to be to change the way that markets work so that they take into account present and future costs.
I guess corporations aren't where you focus, but I wonder if they simply become arms of state interests, or you know, our caller's raising the idea that they're with their own interests, and I wonder if you see them as subject to the same kinds of impulses, directions, dark directions that nations or races can take.
Let me take this in a slightly different direction. Mm-hmm. We have drawn some lessons from the Holocaust which don't really make sense. One of the lessons we've drawn from the Holocaust is that Nazi Germany was a big state. It became a big state because it was a welfare state. Therefore, interventions in the market are a bad thing. That's the fairy tale of the American libertarian right. There are other fairy tales, but that's the one that we have in America on a certain kind of the right wing. This is absolutely wrong as history. That Nazi Germany was not an authoritarian state that was a welfare state and so on. Nazi Germany was a place which destroyed other states. So you can't draw the lesson from the Nazi experience that unlimited free markets are a good thing. What one has to do instead is think about is to reject any kind of total ideology. And the ideology that, for example, free markets themselves will generate values, will solve all their problems, it's not the worst of all total ideologies, but it is a total ideology and it has the problems of all of them. One instead has to mix and match. One has to say, okay, markets sometimes, but since they're not a total solution, what can we do with markets which might actually make our survival more likely? In other words, one has to take the Holocaust as a reason to always think in plural terms, to never think that there's only one solution to everything. So markets themselves are obviously not going to solve global warming. There has to be a state, there has to be a public discussion about how we incentivize markets so that we can actually survive. And again, the Holocaust shows very well how even the biggest of corporations can behave extraordinarily badly if the incentive structures are wrong.
Timothy Snyder, you write recently, today we confront the same crucial choice between science and ideology that Germans once faced. What do you mean exactly by that?
I'd here like to seize on a very important point that Frank made about what he calls political decisions. Because what we don't want to say is that the world is so bad that there's nothing we can do about it. The challenges are real, just as they were for Germans in the 1930s. They're not exactly the same, but they're certainly real. The question is how we apprehend them. Do we go along the Nazi line, which is to say there is no future because science can't save us? It's normal to be anxious and want to seize all you can. it's normal to want ever more and more and more, which are the arguments, by the way, of Hitler's first and second book. Or do we understand that there is a politics to all this? Do we try to be self-aware? Do we try to think about the future? So what I mean, of course, is that we're facing a basic choice between ideology and science. When I say that, I mean ideology are the things which comfort us in the world that we're used to living in. Science is the vision of how we can creatively change things so that our children or our grandchildren face less anxiety than we do now. And I mean it very seriously, because the Germans in the 1930s were not less sophisticated than we are. They weren't less moral than we are. They faced very similar choices. And we can see how people who had ethical thought, who were quite sophisticated, went down what is very clearly the wrong road. It was a road which, you know, they were living in a global world just like we are. The Holocaust was a certain end to the first globalization. We are now in the second globalization. We're feeling similar temptations. We're feeling similar threats. And the question is, how are we going to handle globalization? That's a political decision. It's one that we still have time to make. We do have time to make it, but we have to recognize it as a decision, and we have to take responsibility now.
Is there a gamble that might be made that Hitler was such an unusual catalyst for everything that unfolded, and Hitlers are rare, so yes, we have vulnerable circumstances, but what's the likelihood of a Hitler coming into the middle of this? We can muddle through.
Well, the problem with all of that is that things that aren't a Holocaust are pretty bad. So if you think about what Germany does over the course of basically 3 years, it not only tries to exterminate all the Jews on the planet and leads to the murder of 5.5 million of them, it also unleashes a war in which there are further tens of millions of civilian and military casualties. So that's what a resource war looks like when it's undergirded by a specific ideology of extermination. There can be other such things. We shouldn't be comforted if they don't look just like Nazi Germany. They won't look like Nazi Germany, but that doesn't mean that they're not coming.
Why take any of these risks at all? Though we already are taking risks. Look to science, look to political institutions, be creative, Timothy Snyder says. His terrific new book is Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning, professor of history at Yale. Timothy Snyder, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Francesco Femia at the Center for Climate and Security in Washington. Frank, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.